Hello and welcome to The Whole Health Cure, a space for trustworthy, science-based information on how you can live healthier, longer, and happier naturally. I'm your host, Dr. Sharon Berquist, a practicing Yale and Harvard-trained physician and scientist with 3 decades of experience specializing in chronic disease prevention, longevity, and human performance, and author of The Stress Paradox, Why You Need Stress to Live Longer, Healthier, and Happier. Today's conversation focuses on defining, measuring, and predicting how well we age, a topic that is so near to my heart. In other words, will you be able to live independently and do the things you love? Aging well, as we know, isn't just about preventing disease or extending health span. We're going to see that it's about extending function, how long we maintain the physical and cognitive capacities required for living well. And I'm joined by Scott Fulton, who's an internationally recognized redefiner in the positive aging space. A researcher, author, and adult educator, he teaches at 3 prominent universities on health span and aging. He's a member of the American College of Lifestyle Medicine, sits on the prestigious True Health Initiative Council, and is past president of the National Aging in Place Council. Coming from a diverse engineering research background, he's known for translating complex science into applied, evidence-based preventive lifestyle medicine for aging well. He's the author of Wealth Span, and his latest book, Function, challenges some of the messaging around health span. It turns out that what we actually do in everyday life is the most reliable predictor of health span. Scott, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Sharon. I'm delighted to be back with you, and thanks for the kind introduction.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. So, Scott, I think you bring such a unique perspective to aging, and I want to start by kind of asking you, first of all, what you do and how you arrived at this approach of looking at functional age.
I wear many hats depending on the hour of the day that you catch me. In general terms, I'm really focused around educating everyday people on what are the practical aspects of health that we can bring forward that really anyone can do. And that goes to teaching. So I teach at 3 universities around the country. One of them in person, I can't be in 3 different cities at once. My course at Northwestern goes out to 50 schools around the country concurrently. It's a great opportunity to reach out to adults who maybe didn't get the health education. I didn't get it early in life. And not to turn them into scientists, but really to help them understand some of the gaps that we never learned earlier, that doctors never learned in medical school, that might apply to them, to really apply to decisions they make around their health choices and their daily habits. And really, my approach is, my background's engineering, so I'm all about what are practical solutions that we can adopt easily. And so there are things that you can choose within a framework that fit your priorities, that fit your culture, that really are the choices that I think if we listen out on the airwaves, we get into the minutiae pretty quickly in a lot of conversations. And that's fine if you're ready for that level of detail. But I'm more about the foundation of how do you make sure you don't have cracks in your foundation that you're not aware of. You're kind of distracted by all the shiny, witty and clever conversations going on out there. And that's where I see a big need out there. And so that's really where I'm trying to serve.
I think that is so needed. There's a lot of, you know, critique of the health system because subspecialties work somewhat siloed between the cardiologist and the nephrologist. But I see a lot of that same happening in the wellness space and in the space of longevity, in that some people are promoting treatments that are stacks of supplements. Some people are putting forth, you know, hyperbaric chambers and infrared treatments. And there isn't that cohesiveness, and the consumers are left oftentimes just trying to piece together, like, what do I really need? How do I incorporate this wearable into the advice I'm being given in this other space? And it's creating a bit of that same siloing where there isn't that unity between what we're trying to do, how we're trying to accomplish it. How did you get at function as such a core foundational concept?
It's a great question. I wish I could give you a really succinct answer. I think at the heart of it is I'm just interested in really good quality, large volumes of data, and not having any particular flag to wave around this, really around the whole health span issue, because as you point out, there's so many people pitching different nuances and totally different ideas. I just am always searching for good quality data. And my background being in engineering and research and my athletic background, I think, is a good example, right? As a runner, I enjoy running, I enjoy triathlon, but I know that I can follow a training schedule. And based on my running pace and my heart rate over a number of weeks, I have some reasonable prediction of what my race time should be. And if I follow my plan, I'll usually come very close to that. And I kind of ask that question, well, why are we so all over the map around health span? We have people pitching ideas, but no one actually tells us these are the metrics or the milestones that you can measure along the way we might think about pacing for a run. And again, you don't have to be a runner to appreciate this, but the concept, it holds up. And so I started to dig around, and I've got a bit of a background in accessibility and disabilities. And I started to think, well, how do we measure those things? And it just kind of started to ask questions that led me to functional data. And I started to dig into it. There is enormous functional data. And even within the functional clinical work, there are over 30 subspecialties. The most comprehensive is geriatrics. But geriatrics isn't worried about what a 40-year-old is looking like or a 50 or a 60-year-old. So they're at the end of the cycle. They're the most holistic. And the younger you go, the more divided the subspecialties are. They're looking at the sports injury, for example. How do I get a pro athlete back on the game field? Occupational therapists are certainly at play. We look at development from early childhood. I use walking as a great one because it's the most uniform across the lifespan. As a newborn, we're looking for when is that first step happens? Around a year nominally, we're all excited about that. And we're kind of the doctors checking in on those things. And once you get to be 16 or so, we don't even think about those things anymore unless you're in the school track and field. We don't look at it again until you run into troubles walking much later in life. Well, all of the scientists and clinicians out there have actually been tracking all this data across a lifetime because they're trying to benchmark what are we comparing to. And so we have lifespan data around something as simple as walking, and we know that we can characterize how you walk today. What does that look like 10, 20, 30 years down the road? And once I started to reach into that data, it just came back to me with so much information that we could start to bring to everyday life. And it's more than one domain. And I think that's the key part of what I discovered in the course of it too, is we're far too singular in the way we think about things, like even something like VO2 max. Yes, it's a great indicator, but it's not the best indicator. It relies on correlation as much as many of the other things we hear about.
Maybe we should also take a step back and kind of define some terms. So what is health span? What do you look at when you think of lifespan? And what is the role of functional ability within that umbrella?
I think it goes back to your opening comments, which I think were so appropriate. Health span, we really have two definitions. So there's the medical definition that really describes your disease-free. But when I talk to people out there on the street and in my class, that's not their metric because they know that we can operate and do all the things we want. Disease may have some impact on that, depending on where we are in the cycle or development of a disease. But we have lots of ways through medicine to be able to help people. Like I could say hypertension, right? So does hypertension slow people down? Not so much. It may have some complications if it's not addressed later. So where everyone in the real world, I'll say, outside of medicine views health span is, it's answered by the question I ask all my classes. How long do you want to live? And almost without exception, as long as I can continue to do the things that I want to do and ultimately the things that I need to do. That's really, I think, the most appropriate definition of health span that's largely gone unaddressed.
I think that's so powerful because, you know, we get asked that. And what you bring to light, I think, with introducing all the domains, which we'll get into, is the predictive capability. So much of what we're trying to do in healthcare, and I work a lot around prevention, is the reason we test the blood biomarkers, the reason we test even VO2 max, which, as you mentioned, has gotten a lot of attention, is because we want to try and give people information as to whether they're on track to age healthily. Yet, the predictive power of what we're trying to do compared to some of the things that you introduce in your book doesn't quite have this predictive capability. So can you talk about this health trajectory, like the data we have based on the things we can measure that can help people predict how they're going to age functionally, being able to do the things they want to do for as long as they want to do? And I think that is such a beautiful way to frame health span, define it, and make that our goal.
Yeah, I think there's two parts to that. And so one of them, which I picked up on a few years ago and I started to bring in, was like when we talk about risk of heart attack or myocardial infarction, right? We talk about in medicine around, well, here's the risk. Here's your 5 and 10 year risk. To the layperson, that's really kind of, okay, so I have a risk, but I don't really know what to do with that information. And even as clinicians, right, it's hard to know. There's no certainty around it, just, and it's hard to differentiate your case from the general public. And so if we think about function, because it's the things that we do every day, it's highly repetitious and it's highly predictive. So if we think about all of the things that we do in the course of daily living, we're really well practiced at it. If I kind of think about that in terms of health span, it's more about how intentional we are. We do these things, but do we do them with intention? And it's that intention that starts to change the trajectory. And so if we think about, I'll use walking as one, but it could be some of the standard tests, like a chair stand test is a great example of how many times can you stand up and sit down from a chair without using your hands for 30 seconds? Boring, boring test, right? So clinicians don't get excited about doing unless you're in functional health, but it reveals a whole lot because what it says is if you're already using your hands at age 50, you've already required a dependency that you're going to become more and more dependent on as you get older. And so there's those physical things we can see, but also we can measure it. That example is how many times can you do it at age 40, at age 50, at age 60? Yes, it will go down normally, particularly if you don't do anything about it. And we can follow that trajectory all the way through to the point when you cross what everyone is most concerned about and no one talks about is what's the threshold? What number will it start to matter to me? That's part of what I was trying to help people with too, is this is the end point you need to be focused on. And let's look backwards and get the engineer in me says, how can I reverse engineer health and longevity? We would all love to be able to do that. Well, functional data is there that tells us exactly what we need to do and when, whatever stage we're at in life.
So essentially, what you're able to do today, in this example, that, you know, how many times you can stand from a chair, that can predict how well you'll be able to do it with very scientific data showing per decade the rate of decline and what you can expect in your 70s, 80s, 90s, and depending on where you are today, what that trajectory is going to look like. When we do a test like that, obviously it's going to help predict how well we can stand up from a chair, but there's a lot more information in a test like that. Can you talk about, well, what does that test apply to in daily life, like the other things that I'm going to want to do when I'm older? What does sitting and standing from a chair help me predict?
Right. So again, they seem so simplistic. Perfect question. What are the things it tells us? Well, it tells us mainly about lower body strength. So what's in our quadriceps, primarily our big muscles that we're using to stand up? What is it about our mobility, our freedom to make that movement? And particularly as we're coming down, right, sitting down in a chair, we've seen how that can be a challenge for people. also from balance, because everything isn't always laid out perfectly in front of us. If it's the chair at home that we always, our go-to chair, we may understand that quite well, but we're in a new environment and things are a little bit different, or we're trying to get on a bus seat or some other place. You know, the bus is moving would be, there's another example, right? It's in a dynamic situation and I need to be able to do that safely. The more that our mobility, our balance, and our strength are all working together for us, and cognitively, this is the other part that we tend to think about cognition as our thinking side of the brain. Well, cognition is involved essentially in our neuromotor response to the connection to say, how far away is that seat that I'm trying to get to? And am I on path to hit that seat and I'm ready for it? And maybe I'll use the bus example. I'm holding a post to balance me. Where should I grab that post? What height? When should I let go of the post to know that I'm safely going to land on the seat? So we take that and now we can apply it to things like going upstairs. Again, things we do every day today, we don't give it much thought. Well, the pace that we go upstairs is quite meaningful. And it's quite telling just the way standing up from a chair, walking is. So we know that at certain levels or speeds that you go upstairs are predictive of at what point is that going to be problematic for you. So it really kind of applies to anything. Lower body is really what allows us to move around in daily life in all sorts of circumstances. That's, for most people, kind of number one in the health span department. Lose the ability to move freely in lower body strength and ability will be problematic. So I'd like to know about that as early as I can.
You talk about function in five domains. I think that's one of, again, the really unique things that you bring forward, because, again, so much comes out in isolation. Some people focus on VO2 max, which really is one of the domains, or on grip strength, which is popularized as well. But you bring this all together under five domains. Can you tell us those five domains? And then I'd love to also talk about the synergy of why it's so important to kind of do this in a very 360 way and think of all these domains.
VO2 max, I'd say we would regard as the gold standard, and I get an annual lab VO2 max, so this is not a bashing of VO2 max at all. It's really a recognition of that's only telling part of the story, and it's more informative than all the others, which tells you that all of these others are really just little nuggets. The functional portfolio is really to say, well, what are the nuggets that I can put together myself quite easily? And so it's really five domains when we think about function. There's strength and power, which we kind of talked about already with the standing up, you know, climbing stairs and things. You know, maybe you're a runner or a cyclist. All those are kind of in the strength and power realm.
Yeah, I'm a runner too. Yeah.
And cardiovascular and recovery, that's heart function, obviously, and cardiovascular, heart and lungs, but also that recovery after exercise. So we've elevated our heart rate. How long does it take our heart rate to come down? That's another key indicator of functional fitness. And then we move into the things that we generally pay less attention to in everyday life, mobility and balance. Again, things we tend to think about late in life. There's actually a lot we know about mobility and balance earlier. So single leg balance is probably one of the most familiar ones. How long you can stand on one leg at the age of, again, 40, 50, 60 is quite telling. It doesn't suddenly magically get better and it doesn't fall off a cliff. It's quite predictive. Spinal rotation, your ability to turn and look at things like we think about in the car before we had backup mirrors or backup cameras, we had to turn our necks around and we would notice with older adults real limitations. That was part of why they had more accidents, was they just didn't have the ability to turn far enough to look behind and relying on mirrors. The other is flexibility and structure. That's things like in terms of our ability to bend over, simple things like bend over to tie your shoes, pick something up off the floor. And structure are the elements of what's happening with our posture and our body position. We've seen people that tend to kind of curl over as they get older. So essentially the walls are closing in around those people. And so we want to find out about that early and do some preventive measures and get them back on track, which is much easier when we know about it. And then the fifth one is neuromotor and cognition. And that's really, again, I touched on earlier, it's really two ways to think about it. One is, how well is our brain communicating with our muscle and our skeletal system, controlling our movements and our reaction time. So one of the common ones people might remember is a ruler drop test. Really, really simple test. Drop a ruler, and how long does it take to catch that ruler? And we know that because it's gravity. I simplified it even further and said, well, you can just do, you know, so many inches or centimeters on a ruler, and that'll tell you what the reaction time is. Yes, it will slow down with age, but how fast is it slowing down? And then the other part of cognition, which I think is maybe the most interesting once you get the foundation in place, is what's going to happen in later life to my brain in terms of what am I doing to drive neuroplasticity all through my adult years so that I've got cognitive reserve. And this functional reserve, you know, cognitive reserve is just one of the functional reserves we want to have in place. Everything I've talked about is reserve, right? It's for reserve that we need when we think about resilience. Resilience is really what's the reserve that you have. And so that's the example there of people who have plaques in their brain, which we associate with Alzheimer's, but they have no Alzheimer's symptoms. And so we know from those studies now that it's because they've been really driving neuroplasticity all through their adult years. And so they've essentially constantly generated new pathways for information to flow through the brain. It's not as quick as it was, again, when you were 40, but it's still high functioning. And so that's really where it all starts to come together. And we get into, to me, the whole part of this gets pretty exciting. We get into dual task training, where we start to do the body and the brain together. And that's when really we're into the gaming aspects of things that people like to do with games anyway.
You've mentioned some of the assessments, and I want to kind of get into some of the others because, like you said, they're simple but so powerful and so predictive. And you just mentioned the drop ruler test. We've mentioned VO2 max, the sitting and standing. What are some of the other ones in these different domains that people can do? And probably even more importantly, let's say we discover we're in the 25th percentile and we want to work our way up. How do we begin that process so that we can improve how we function as we get older?
So the way I organized the work was to realize there's a lot of ways to measure. And if we're going to rely on multiple metrics, which is a good thing, we need to carefully select what those metrics are. So what I came up with was, again, go back to the experts and look at what are all the standardized tests where we have lots and lots of data. So I didn't make up a single thing here in the data. It's really all standard tests, over 700,000 test subjects that we followed for over five decades to understand what are these domains, but also I organized them in a way that we could put them into tiers because it's too much to throw everybody all at once. So let's start with what I call tier one, which is really the most informative, the most easily understood and easy to adapt. And so that's things like, so I talked about the chair stand and climbing stairs, a 6-minute walk test. One of the standard tests, if you can walk for 6 minutes, there's information around that. Resting heart rate, as we're just sitting here, that's informative, what our resting heart rate is. Single leg stand, I talked about that. And gait speed kind of ties it in a little bit differently. Again, there's some nuances here where balance and mobility start to come in. There's other things which are pure cognitive tests, which are one what I call the color card test. And it's really this combination of, if you've seen an example of, there's a word up there that's written in green, but the word is red. And you start flashing these at people. How long does it take you to resolve what your eye sees and your brain figures out? Am I supposed to say the word or the color? Simple, simple test to do, but because there's so much data, it's quite revealing. Things like we add a conversation to when we go for a walk. So that 6-minute walk test, now let's start to introduce a conversation between two people. So if you and your friend go out for a daily walk together, let's do it with a little intention. Now let's start to talk about something that requires some cognitive effort to resolve a problem you're working on or something. Again, how much the walk slows down because cognition is requiring or recruiting too much of that neuromotor energy that you need to be able to do something as repetitious as walking. So all in all, I've got 44 tests that are these sort of tests that people can do. ultimately, no one, I'm sure some will do all 44. The idea is find ones that are of interest to you, that you're curious about, that you can do fairly easily. That will take you on to some other things. So there's lots of places to explore, like a single leg squat test. We talk about single leg balance. Now try a single leg squat. So there's levels of difficulty as we go through. So the second part of your question was, okay, so what? So I found out that I'm 25th percentile. Oh my gosh, this is terrible. Well, so what I added in there was, because if it's not obvious, the best way to practice it is to do some repetitions over the course of a day and work on those lower body things. So things like getting up from the chair, not using your hands, are going to help single leg squats, which are far more challenging. So they all start to work together once you develop really a very limited amount of awareness is all that's needed, and you start to become more intentional about everyday activities. So the idea is you can see what 25th percentile, I don't put 25th percentile in, I start with median or 50th percentile, because that's really where you need to be if you're thinking at all about health span. You've got to at least be at 50th percentile. And then I've got two more. I've got 75th percentile. So you'd start to say, what do I need to start doing? And there's some, again, recommendations around what people can do to start to get to 75th percentile. And if you'd like to get to 90th percentile, that's in there too. So the idea is really to say, this isn't about an exercise routine you need to do. For most of what we talk about in functional health, you will get just by being intentional around everyday activities you already do. Exercise supplements that. And so if you want to get to 90th percentile, yeah, you're probably going to require some exercise to get there. If 75th percentile is your goal and you say, I'm fine with that because the outcome of that is pretty good, great. So you've got some benchmarks to align with what you're actually doing with what your expectations are. And that's really, I think, part of what I've tried to do with this too is to match up expectations with reality.
And it really frames the types of activities that we should be doing if we want to be able to function well, do the things we love as we get older, instead of starting some workout routine that we're just trying to move, which is often very good advice, just move more. But this really frames, do these assessments, then if you're not on target, then, and I should add, what I love is these assessments are easy, free, do at home, no cost. I mean, this is just beautiful. And if you're not where you are, then, you know, the body works in a use it or lose it capacity. So you're losing this capacity. You've got to use it. So here are trainable ways to gain better function in the things that are going to matter. Is there anything you would add to that?
I think what's surprising for people is, because this isn't an exercise prescription, it's the things you're already doing today. No one says, well, I'm not going to get up out of a chair anymore because I don't like doing that. Really, none of this is about that.
We don't balance enough on one leg. We should do more of that.
Yeah. That's the perfect example, right? And yeah. I have a lot of athletic friends around me who are well-trained and some have MD after their name. And we all are guilty of this. Right? We focus on the things where we feel we're strong, that we're competent, that people acknowledge and recognize for what we're good at. That's great, but that's not what's going to dictate your health span ultimately.
This really touches on what I think is one of the most powerful messages you have, which is the blind spots. And I think that's where you're going, where it's the weakest link that's going to hold you back, not your strongest suit. Can you talk more about that? Because I think that should be repeated and shouted from the rooftops.
Right. Again, if you think about the messaging we get, like, and again, VO2 max is one of the ones we hear. It's great to have strength, but it's also really easy to kid ourselves that because we're strong in two or three things relative to our peers, that we're good because it's what I like to do already. We gravitate to the things where we feel confident in. The reality is, we all know this intuitively, but no one seems to talk about it, is that's not what dictates your health span. It will be the weak link. And so you raised up balance as a great example. Literally yesterday, I'm getting rehab for my torn hamstring, and I'm listening to the woman beside me who's not that old talking about recent falls that she's had, and one was up in the middle of the night. And these are the normal things that will happen in terms of the trigger will happen or the initiator will happen. Whether you fall or not is really this reserve we talk about that you already have in place around the different domains. Strength won't help you when you fall. We can think of the bodybuilder. These are extreme examples, but they don't necessarily apply to that degree. Not noted for having great flexibility or balance. So find a focus on building strength, right? That's great. But don't think that compensates for flexibility and balance. And don't think that's going to help you necessarily with your neuromotor and cognition. Those are separate domains that will be benefited by all the other things. So strength training will improve it. On its own, it's not enough. And so what we want to find out, and that was really what I set about to do this, was to understand how would each of us find our own weak link? We get all the advice around, you know, you should be doing more strength training. You should be doing more cardiovascular training. Probably, but maybe that's not really where you need the most help. It may be in some other area that really no one's talking about. Well, I'll worry about balance when I get older, would be kind of the self-talk we have. So this is really a way to start to identify where are your blind spots or your gaps. And thankfully, as we talked about earlier, these are the easiest things to improve. Because they're relatively low, it's much easier to get to median, and it's much easier to get to 75th than if you're already at 75th and you're trying to get to 90th because you want to beat whomever, you want to be the, you got a 10K coming up. And so it's this weak link thing that we need to start to think about, it, not as criticism of ourselves, but as an opportunity to invest in our future, because those will be the most valuable investments we make. And so your weak link is different than someone else's. So listening to this generic advice around what we should be doing, this is really a chance to stop and say, hang on, what's my weak link? That's the only thing that matters, is what's my weak link and how do I raise it up, and then find what we describe as the low-hanging fruit. These are the easiest things to fix once you find them. But if you don't know where they are, that's the thing that will creep up and catch you later.
And I think that we're all susceptible to that because we gravitate towards what we love doing, right? If we love running, we're going to have better VO2 max, but our balance and some of the other functionalities can be very weak. And what I'm hearing you say is you're better off trying to get to, say, 50 or 75th percentile across the board in all these domains and trying to get into 99th percentile into one or two, while the others could be like lagging below 50 percentile.
Exactly. And I'll use myself as an example, partly because I'm going through rehab right now and I'm being forced to do things that I ordinarily wouldn't do. I have a very high VO2 max. I've had that for several years. It goes back to my Ironman training. And I continue to have a high VO2 max. So part of rehab for this hamstring was I've got to do a whole lot of single leg balance exercises now. Was I doing them before? No. Did I know about them? Yes. Not before I started to do the book, but it made it very aware to me of all the circumstances where I'm on one foot and don't even think about it. And the benefits now that I've done so much training over the last several weeks, my strength, when I say strength on one leg, not muscular strength, but my strength in terms of competency and ability to recover because I'm practicing and I'm doing complex movements. And so I'm potentially falling all the time, but I'm catching myself. And so that's part of what balancing is not so much how much your balance is perfect, is what's your ability to catch yourself from falling. And that's really that kind of cliff. And we talk about the cliff as where is it? And what's the fall going to be like if I get there? And so how can I soften that? However it might look like to us, we want to make sure that we've got a good understanding what that is and not have it blindside us, because that's what happens, right? If we get blindsided with things like, I had no idea. And reality is we could have found that out decades ago.
And I think that is really a great point. And I want to conclude by having you help us put all of this information in context of magnitude of what ultimately moves the needle in predicting how we're aging. So as possible predictors, there are things like my current age is probably going to predict how long and how well I live. My body mass index may, my blood sugar may, my blood pressure may, and they all do. But can you help us put things in context in terms of magnitude? Because there are so many things we could all be working on, and we're told that we need to work on all of them, and it's all important. But then it gets very hard to prioritize because you could be going in so many directions. Can you help us put these functional assessments and working on our functional ability in the context of what we already know are predictors?
If I were to think about it that way, maybe one way to think about it is, again, which I introduced this concept of functional age. Mm-hmm. The functional age is really simply saying, where are you now relative to your chronological age? If your functional age is lower than your chronological age, that ultimately is a great sign. If it's that case in all five domains, that's a great sign as well. Starting to think about yourself as what's my functional age is, again, a different way of looking at health span. It's a different way of looking at health and aging. And I think what happens is because this is so relatable for people, it makes it easier to start to pull in the other elements of health and wellness that we all talk about. So will it improve my diet? Directly, no. Indirectly, probably. Because if I can see my functional performance getting better, if I get better sleep, if I eat a little bit better, and if I start doing this walk and do it a little more challenging, I'm probably going to actually have more success at losing a few pounds that I've been wondering why they haven't just gone away. And that's the simple thing of, you know, maybe I do a 30-minute walk, but my 30-minute walk has gone up by 5% in speed. So I didn't mention that earlier, but great example would be just going by 0.1 meters per second faster walking, which is about 4 inches, not big, is worth about 10 more years of health span. What happens with this, what I've seen happen is that people look at health span differently and they start to own it. Because now it's around something I can get my hands around, and now I'm willing to put some other things on top of it that before I tried and kind of went away. This is now something you can build and take with you all the way through. And it doesn't require a lot of ongoing maintenance, again, because it's everyday things. You'll know how you're doing and you can do quick checks. So I think it's really core. I view it as a vital sign that we've somehow overlooked and we've waited until far too late, because that's what medicine is there for. It's to catch us after we fall, not decades earlier. It's really core to how people view health span and how they view their current health.
Yeah. And in a world where we're all looking at biomarkers and epigenetic aging, and including myself, you know, this is such a great reminder of, you know, our ancestors just did and didn't have gyms and et cetera. And what they did a lot of, they were very good at, and that allowed them to continue doing what they were doing. And I love how foundational that is, and that kind of revisiting in a very structured evidence-based way that you've pulled it together is really phenomenal. So I loved your book. And tell us, Scott, where people can find you, where they can find the book and get access to these 44 assessments so that they can start doing them themselves at home.
The book is on Amazon. You can either get Kindle or the paperback, and it's Function, Turn Your Blind Spots into Strengths. That's the easiest place to find it. You can also learn about the book on WealthSpan. That's HealthSpan with a W in front. I've got a page devoted to Function so people can learn a little bit more about it if they didn't get enough information here. Everything I've done with this is to make everything accessible. I've tried to make it really affordable for people and engaging, and make it a really easy read for them too. It's not a big investment in the reading. Most of the book is made up of all the tests. One page is here's the test, and the other page is here's some things you can do to get better.
Yeah, you've really done a tremendous amount of work to make it so simple and distilled just so much information from different specialties and distilled it to something that's so practical. So thank you for doing all this work, and thank you for the conversation.
Well, thanks, Sharon. I always enjoy any conversation with you. Everyone we've had, I've just thoroughly enjoyed it. It's left me thinking of all the things we could be doing, and that's motivational for me, and I really appreciate all that you're doing. It's great service you provide, and so thank you for having me.
Thank you. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode and share it with a friend. Until next time, do something to help improve your whole health naturally.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of any entities they represent.